Blog Talk Radio.
Turn the corner. Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the road. Travel through time and space. So much to learn. So much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind. In your heart, gain new knowledge for a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
This is MJ Network, and I'm waiting for Shannon Kirk to call in. I am calling her, and I am not getting an answer, so I'm going to give it a few minutes and see what happens. I am trying to call the author of In the Vines, and for some reason,
hello?
She's not answering the phone. Hello, it's Fran. Shannon?
Oh, my God, Fran? Yeah?
Yes, I'm calling you because you didn't call in. It's a good thing I have your cell phone number.
Oh, my God,
we're on
I'm
the
so
air.
Sorry.
We,
sorry,
is this
that,
okay
that,
to
yeah.
do it? Do you need me to change it or something? We're on the air, seriously.
Okay, apologies. My calendar. Yeah, we can do this. If you can hear me, okay.
I can hear you just
my
fine.
Calendar. I'm just looking at it right now. Got really messed up, and for some reason this got to 10 p.m. So that makes no sense. But. Yeah, if it's okay with you, and you can hear me fine, happy to proceed.
No, I'm here. I'm here, yeah. It's a good thing I have your cell phone number. We're talking to myself.
I know.
That's no good.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that, Fran.
That's okay. I've got it. So we're talking to the author of In the Vines, Shannon Kirk, and I'm going to put it on my Facebook wall that I'm on the air. And your buy link is on my wall. So how did you create Aunt Liv and Mop? And what would you say was their relationship?
I would say that their relationship is, I would say that it's typical of a lot of aunt and niece relationships that I've witnessed, at least, where an aunt and a niece are really especially close, almost like a second mother. So that, I would say, is the relationship. How I created them, I think, is the first part of your question.
Mm-hmm.
Auntie is sort of an amalgam of psychological issues. She's created out of my idea of panic disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. And that's based on heredity, but it's also based on environment and her upbringing, and also some tragedies that she's had and how it has impacted her. So that's how she's created, somebody with that disorder, with those traumas, who comes from an incredibly wealthy family, what would she be like? That's how I created her. Mop is my idea. And I actually have the lengthiest note to my editor on the creation of Mop and the background of her. But she's this person that I see out in the world from time to time. It's maybe like once a year. And it's always sort of a young adult woman who is completely composed and fully together. And you can tell she's incredibly inquisitive of the world, but also not judgmental of the world, because she has so many doubts about everything, but not crippling doubts, not doubts like Chidi on The Good Place, right, where it suffocates him, but more of inquisitive doubts, right? Like, why should I believe XYZ just because somebody told me? I want to explore that myself. So she's an intellectual, and she's also a person with incredible heart who just absolutely loves to the ends of the earth the people that she allows in her life, who are admittedly limited. So, long answer, but that's how I created them.
Well, I think she was created in my family, Mom, seriously.
Oh, really?
Because we're all, we're all the same way, yeah. Uh-huh.
Cool.
When my mom would say, if a family member needs you to do something, I don't care if you have 17 term papers to do, you have to help them first. And I go, Mom, I'm going to be up till midnight. Don't worry about it. It's the same thing. So why would you say, you developed this story, it was interesting, in two different time periods and in two different voices. How come you went back and forth until the different two time periods? And it created like almost two novels.
Okay, so I did the two different time periods because part of this book, right? So I get that the organization of this book is a bit complicated, I think. It certainly was complicated, right? But I did that because the whole book, right, is about anxiety. It's about that spinning out of control feeling. That's the whole point of the book. And if you are a person who is lucky enough to not have experienced panic attacks, for example, right, you might not recognize that's sort of the organization of this book, is this back and forth, you know, present, past, and it's part, so the construction of it in part is to give that feeling. The other thing that so that's a main reason why I went back and forth in time. The other reason was just simply practicalities, right? I couldn't necessarily write this book chronologically and keep the breakneck, what I was trying to do was a breakneck sort of roller coaster ride of the psychological drama happening and also the action. And so I wanted it to feel like a tornado spinning clockwise and a hurricane spinning counterclockwise. And to do that, I had to organize it with the past and the present issues that have happened.
Well, I got that, but, this is interesting. It was interesting. Yeah, I got it. So what would you say is what drives Mob? In chapter one, she calls after, and how did you create the scene that somebody's after her and why? So I became nervous throughout the novel, like, who's going to get Mob? They better not get Mob because we need her for Aunt Viv, who's a little out of her mind.
Right. So the question, I think, is how did I create that first scene in starting the book? Okay.
Uh-huh.
It's a great question and an interesting one because it's one that I debated with my editor, right?
Mm-hmm.
My editors, it used to be much longer, by the way. The first chapter was much more extensive on Mop's present situation, and then a little more backstory on Mop. But the editor, I have actually two great editors at Amazon, and they came back and they said, we think that you should start with Auntie, the Auntie chapter in the present, in 2 years ago in the restaurant, because Auntie's voice is easier to get into, right? Mop's voice is more complex. It's got poetry infused in it, and it's harder to get into right away, to wade into. And my response to that was, and I usually take all of my editor's suggestions because they're always right, but there's usually about 2-5% that I don't take. And what I didn't take for this was, I did not think it was right to start with Auntie because Auntie is not the main character. Auntie is a main character, but she's not the main character. The main character is Mop. And I don't like to start books without the main character. The main character, in my mind, should start a book. That's just my opinion. Many people can disagree. And I also don't like to start books with that slow ramp up. I want to start a book in the middle of the storm. Like, what is the main malfunction that the main character has to resolve by the end of this book. And you know that right away from the first chapter.
Mm-hmm.
The main malfunction
yeah.
is that Mop, the main character, has to get out of this hole and not be hacked up with a hatchet-wielding woman, right? That's the main
mm-hmm.
problem. Now, there's a ton of other problems in the book that various characters have to overcome, but my strong belief for how I want to organize books is to start with the main nugget, like the main thread throughout the whole thing. So that's why you get that first chapter. The concession I had with my editors was, okay, I see your point that it's, we need to get to Auntie faster, though. So I cut it
mm-hmm.
way down. I think it's way down to 2 pages, right? So that's
well,
how that
I have
was.
The book in front of me. I'll tell you in a second. I've got the book in front of me. It's one of the few. It's what, 2.5 paragraphs paragraph on this third page. And,
okay, yeah.
And she's
so
talking.
I think it was maybe 3-4 times longer in the original
oh, wow.
version. Yeah. I had
to do a lot of
reorg.
So when the editor says cut it, you just do it or not do it. It's up to you, I guess.
Well, it is ultimately up to you, but I
mm-hmm.
well, what I'm finding at least is if your main editor wants a significant structural change, you pretty much
mm-hmm.
have to do it. But
oh, wow.
also, right, balance. I mean, of course, I guess you could refuse, but then I don't know where your book would go then. But there's always, it's a back and forth. If you have a good editor, it's a dialogue, and you figure out
mm-hmm.
a good balance of what makes you happy, what makes them happy. And really, I've found personally that my editors are always right anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm being blind to something because I've lived the book too long writing it.
And I have an editor, too, but all she does is correct my typos and mistakes and say, I make comments about what to change. But since I'm not in, you know, in a regular publisher, I'm in a different kind of publishing company. Even when I wrote the last one, I'm in a traditional publishing company, and they just like, I had my cousin read it because she's an editor. I said, just tell me what I did wrong, what I have to fix. So we have Aunt Lib, and this scene had to be one of my favorites. Why did she need to keep it a secret? The scene in the restaurant with Kate and Vicky. This started a chain of diabolical events. So who is Kent, and why don't we really get to know him? But that was, oh, my God. Between Kate and Vicky, she's vicious. I wouldn't want to be close to her, that's for sure. Oh, my God. It's like, that was so cool, though, the way she did it.
Thank
and
you.
She got away with it. That's
thank
even
you.
Scary.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that, by the way, that restaurant is obviously, it's not, I totally renamed it to Proserpina's
mm-hmm.
and so it's like a fake venue, but in my mind, it's based on an actual restaurant in Boston called Marliov's. And,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know if anyone would pick up on that, but a friend of mine who lives in the area called me up and she said, this is totally Marliov's, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it's totally Marliov's, which is this old, awesome Italian restaurant in Boston. It's just knuckled right into this alley.
That is amazing. And, of course, the fact that Olive was watching and listening and didn't care. So we realize that
yeah.
we learned that she's, I just said this, she didn't stop anything. She just said, oh, this is cool, get rid of her, why not? So what
yeah.
do we learn? Yeah, that's so scary. I mean, we learn that she's delusional and she's spiraling out of control and she's totally insane, right? And she's justifying
yeah.
in her own mind that it's okay not to do anything about this person that wants to kill somebody else. And it's like, this is so cool. What a way to get rid of somebody and get away with it. And felt sorry for her. Oh, my God, I'm going to help you. Yeah, not really.
Yeah, so, yes, yeah, so he's... Yeah, so Auntie Liv is clearly battling mental illness, and she, at
mm-hmm.
times in her life, has overcome them and managed them, and one way that she manages them is to throw herself into being a nurse, but a lot of times she fails, and this is clearly a
mm-hmm.
scene right up front to show her failing, and her fail, obviously a normal person would act, but she's suffering from confusion about the whole situation, right? And also in some ways, Auntie believes that she's above the law. She's elitist.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the most, she's the most wealthy family in New England, right? So
mm-hmm.
she looks upon the regular community, law enforcement, the law, the courts, politicians, with disdain. So probably in her twisted mind, she's sitting there thinking, well, I'm not going to insert myself. This is for people beneath me. And also, if I insert myself, it will make my life more complicated. So that's her motivation in that scene.
She's my kind of person. What can I tell you? What the heck? I'm going to do it my way. Dare you cross me? Well, I just got off the phone with some interesting people that explained to them, just fix the problem because you don't want to know what happened. You know, just let me just fix it. So we have another auntie. We have Auntie's sister Mary Patience, and she's not very close with her. What's Mom's problem with her? And how does she learn the truth? And why isn't she close to sister Auntie Mary Patience? Susan's nun
right.
of some
so,
type. Yeah.
She's a nun. So she's not that close with Aunt Sister Mary Patience for two reasons. One is, you know, as I was saying before, Mop doesn't understand living life with beliefs that are so solid and immovable and based on somebody else's dogma. So that doesn't make sense to her psychology, and it bugs her, right? So somebody who's a
mm-hmm.
Catholic nun and in her family and imposing judgments and laws based upon the Catholic Church is somebody who's going to be maybe not toxic, but somebody who Mom
mm-hmm.
is not going to have an inclination to get close with because she doesn't understand that psychology. She doesn't understand how somebody could be like that. So that's one reason. The other reason is, you know, she's grown up very close with Joanna and Liv, her aunt, Auntie Liv,
mm-hmm.
and it starts to come out in the novel, all of the subversive, strategically placed judgments that Liv has given about Aunt Sister Mary, right? So she's said
mm-hmm.
negative things about her, but embedded in other comments, so that Mop has grown up as a little girl hearing negative things, negative connotations of Aunt Sister Mary. Right. And so the arc of their relationship is that, you know, by the end, we learn that she finds a way to connect with Aunt Sister Mary and finds a way that she can look at Auntie Liv's negative commentary in a different context about Sister Mary, so that she can define her differently and be closer to her. It's all about walls, right? It's all about these walls that we build up between ourselves and other people, and what walls should be built and what walls should be broken down.
Well, I know that too. That's interesting. That is interesting. So we have Mop in the barn, and she's got her companion there, and what happens there and what lies are told there? I mean, they sort of like they're close, but then all of a sudden they become not close.
Right. So you mean Mop and the person who I call her companion?
Yeah.
Yep. So, well, they're close without giving any spoilers.
Exactly.
They're close. Right? It's hard to answer, but I think I can do it. I'll try. So they're close because they're close. I mean, they
mm-hmm.
love each
yeah.
other immensely. But, you know, there's been a trauma that's happened between them. And as with any trauma, there's going to be distance and disbelief about what happened or how it happened and how do I accept whatever has happened and accept this same person into my life who I love so much when things have changed. So that's what's going on in the barn. Why in the barn? You know, I just felt that it was a setting that was that has a lot of things going on in it, frankly, right? There's a lot of stuff going on in the barn, and just, I guess, visually in my mind, that's how I see a major event happening.
Well, we've got a strange event. Within the novel, we hear Liv rants and raves out of control behavior, and she rationalizes, and she's completely out of her mind. But there's somebody else in the barn. How did you manage to get that person there, and nobody knows the person is there, without saying who it is? I was like, I sort of figured it out. I go, oh my God, are you kidding me? I was like, oh my God. And that reverts back to a different scene, and I'm saying, oh well, Aunt Liv is really out of her freaking mind here.
Yeah.
Seriously.
She is. So I think, so to answer how does she get away with it without anybody seeing, the simple answer to that is just the physical location. So this is an isolated estate that has boundaries and a long driveway and a chain at the end of the driveway, and there's really no abutting properties of neighbors. And also, a big part of the book is the vegetation around Auntie's property. There's giant maples and giant oaks, and then around that are these twisted corkscrew trees and vines and brambles that make rings and rings of walls, really. So you can't really get onto Auntie's property unless you're specifically invited and the chains are off of the driveway. So that's how she gets away with it. without anybody seeing. Yeah.
Well, she's completely delusional, but at some point she's got a journal, and she sort of, you know, tells her story through the journal also. And that I found interesting, because then you get to know sort of both characters a little bit better. So how did you create the journal so that we got to know something about each one of them? Mostly Liv. She's completely nuts. My kind of person. What can I tell you?
It, I love that you're saying that, and I love the reaction of people who've read the book and have liked it, that they love Auntie Liv. And I think Auntie Liv is, right, somebody who, those are the kind of characters that I connect with, right? The people who are totally damaged and not perfect and maybe trying to be better, but maybe they fail. So Auntie's ranting and ravings, whether it's in a journal or whether it's just in her mind, this is a psychological book. This is a heavy psychological book, and it's one, in my mind, that cannot be told through dialogue, through people talking, right? It's got to be thought processes and rantings, et cetera. So that's, I guess that's, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's how I came to that.
It's scary. I mean, and then if one minute you were during the day, and the next time you're present time, and I'm going like, which nutty character are we going to deal with next? So, but my favorite scene, yep, I know. What is the significance of the vines and the title In the Vine? And by the way, those people that don't know, I posted this with 17 stars a while ago, so in case you didn't read my review, you're missing something. What can I say?
Oh, Fran, thank you. I really appreciate that, and I loved your review. Thank you. I did. It was really fantastic. Thank you. So, In the Vine, so in my mind, this book, all the way up to maybe even up to copy edit, this was called Auntie. I wanted to name it Auntie. Mm. I fought hard to keep the title to be Auntie, but my publisher was of the mind that outside of the New England area, or I think this was my interpretation of what the reaction was, Auntie doesn't have the same creepy vibe that I've come to know that name as. And so in other areas of the country, Auntie, I think, might be viewed as sweet or, you know, like a cozy or something.
Yeah, I would have thought that also.
Okay. So interesting, because, you know, it could be regional, it could be just my family, but I always think of Auntie as, I don't know, it just is a creepy word to me. But so then we, you know, we came up with different titles, and batted a few things around. And the one we all agreed on was In the Vines. And In the Vines has a lot of meaning, right? It has
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of vines in the book, number one, literally. And, you know, nature in this book, I would say, is a character. I spend a lot of time trying to describe nature,
mm-hmm.
nature as a religion even, nature as the setting. And so In the Vines makes a lot of sense. And, you know, one of the subtext themes of the book is religion. And In the Vines also has some religious connotations. So all in all, they were right. It was better to change the title to In the Vines.
Well, I had my, besides that interpretation, if you think about vines, and they could become sort of like Moth and Liv, tangled in a world where they can't get out.
Yeah,
so
totally.
To me,
absolutely.
When
it's,
you say
see,
In the Vines, I mean, yeah. It's sort of like they walk through the outside or whatever, and they can't really find their way. And neither one could find their way in the vines or out of the vines. So I said, that was really cool. But
that's cool. Yeah, no, your interpretation is the better one, actually, because it's true. I mean, that's...
this is due to my reading master and the professor that I had when I went back for my second master that taught me how to look past what's on the page and look deeper into the novel. And I said, I have to blame him for my brilliance. Yeah, and it's worked. And I have to say this to brag. My niece, Katie Rose, is in leadership class, and she's got the talent, too, from what I gathered from the professor that sent me an email about how well she did. I was like, yeah, you're stuck. What can I tell you? You know what's past the page, too. My soon-to-be, hopefully, forensic psychiatrist in about 4 years.
Ooh.
We don't know.
Oh, my
yeah,
gosh.
She's,
that's wonderful.
Yeah, she's scary smart. So, the kitchen scene, you got to describe. That was my favorite scene in the book besides the first one. That kitchen scene had me like, oh, my God, now what's going to happen? Who's going to be dead? Who's going to happen? Oh, my God. How did you create that? And stay sane at the
you.
End. And stay sane at the end of it, right?
That scene was one of those fun writing days where I knew I was up to the part in writing the book where it was going to be the climax of the big main event. And so I sat down and I just followed Auntie through the house and just wrote it. It was really organic. I didn't plan it out. I just went with it. I can't give any spoilers, but the thing that is happening to one character on the stove, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, okay, what would be the most horrible way or most terrifying way for a woman to be in a situation in a kitchen that doesn't involve a knife, right? Or something
mm-hmm.
obvious. And so that's what happened. And then, and I just followed it one day and wrote it out as it was unfolding in my mind. That's
well, you
it.
Know, you did a great job because I could picture it in my mind, and I don't cook, so I don't go near stuff. And after that, I told my husband, bring it out to me because I'm not going in there. I'm serious. It's like, oh, my God. And I mean, and then the joke of it all was I was going over the questions the other day, and I'm saying all of a sudden the fire alarm went on in our building because they're repairing the elevators and something happened with the main whatever. And they go like, you see, this is why fire is no good, and I'm staying under the bed. Leave me alone. Like, I couldn't believe it. It's like, oh, my God. So we have Liv, who has this thing for this guy, Kent. Why does she like him? He's married to somebody else, but she didn't care.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't blame
her.
What
didn't
the heck?
Care.
I don't blame,
yeah,
can't
no,
blame
she,
her. You know, get what you want.
She gets what she wants. Well, that's her life. She always gets what she wants, right? And
yeah, I like that person. That's why I like her.
Yeah, and she doesn't really. Yeah, so that's it. So she just gets what she wants. She likes the sex with him. You know, she thinks he's good in bed. And
oh, well.
You know, maybe he's a means. She does. She calls another guy in her life, the prior boyfriend, a sperm donor. So I think in some ways, Liv views men as a means to get something, a means to get affection,
mm-hmm.
a means to get mm-hmm. sex, and a means to get a child. And so she's somewhat of a twisted feminist in a way, unintentionally, right? Like they, not feminist mm-hmm. in the bad connotation, like men are terrible. I don't mean it like that. But like she's not viewing men as something she needs to fulfill herself in life. It's she's getting something tangible out of men and getting what she wants. So that's,
I mean,
that's
Mop,
her
vision. Mop can't seem to not help her for some reason. She's sort of enthralled with her aunt. For some reason, she gets angry with her. She's not angry with her. And yet, we know that she cares about her, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an unconditional love. So tell us about Kate, a little about her.
Kate?
Has the nerve to be married to Kent, poor thing. Oh, my God. Oh, well, what could you do? Can't have everything.
So Kate I just did as just a traditional bad guy, right? Just a
mm-hmm.
straight up.
Yeah.
Looney Tunes, and she's just, there's nothing likable about Kate, I don't think.
I know.
Hate Kate, hate her. She doesn't, oh God, I had some other things about her that got edited out. I did go a little too far in my dripping hate of Kate. Yeah, I guess I don't know what more to say about her other than she's just got a lot of qualities in a variety of women that I just detest as an author. I mean, as a person, and I just threw them all together and made Kate because she's the villain. There's nothing redemptive about Kate at all. Whereas most
no,
of
there
all
isn't.
My other characters. Nothing at all, because she is straight up 100% villain.
Well, she reminds me of, she's worse than Alexis Carrington, or some of the villains on some of the shows that they're out there now. I mean, she makes Cruella de Vil look good. So, tell us about Joanna and what happened to her, and that would be Mop's mother. So, how did she come into the story?
So Joanna, I'm just going to be careful on spoilers on this one, so I might pause a few times. But Joanna is based on this really lovely, lovely person I know who lives by me, who's just this fashion rainbow of a woman who has the biggest heart and is, you know, she dresses in these wonderfully fashionable, high fashion, colorful outfits, and I think she still has a fashion blog for real, and has lots of money and donates her time to charities and the goodwill of everything, and she's incredibly well read and paints. You know, she's just one of those bright, happy spots in your life. So Joanna is based on her, and thinking of her, I thought, okay, well, if that same person were in a very, very wealthy, wealthy, wealthy family, uber, like 1% of the 1%, what would she be like? Because she would have access to XYZ. And then what would happen if a really bad tragedy happened to her, right? Where she, you know, what would, and not so much what would happen to her, more importantly, what would happen to the people who need her in their lives, who need that bright, happy rainbow in their lives because they're not like that and they need her. So what happens to the whole family structure when that sunshine is extinguished?
I know how that feels. When I lost my sister, that's how I felt when I lost the biggest sunshine in the world. And every morning she would call me at 7:15, "Hello, sunshine. Are we in a good mood over there? Have a cloudy day." I go, "You're on the phone. It's got to be rainy and stormy. Sorry." I mean, seriously. And it was every morning. "Did you give Mom her medicine?" I said, "She's waiting for you. She calls you the good one. I'm the evil one. I'm the, you know, the other, the Kate of the family." and you're the good one, so what can I say? So when you get here, we'll give her her medicine. It was like this banter back and forth. But before I forget, on Monday, I have the author of Napa Noir. On Wednesday, I'm doing something very different. Howard Shapiro would be here with Queen of Kenesha. It's a graphic novel. Never did that before. On the 22nd, the author of Criminal Mind. This is the big deal for the month. I am so excited, besides having you on my show. Carla Negus is going to come on the 25th with Imposter's Law. And right after that, someone else we all know and love, Bruce Coffin, Beyond the Truth. And on the 1st, what better way to start the year, the month off with? James Heyman, Fatal Obsession. Then we have Patricia Hale, Scar Tissue. And then, this is so exciting, John Land with the second installment of Murder, She Wrote. She's doing it, the Jessica Fletcher. It's called Manuscript for Murder. And on the 12th, something very serious. There's a Vietnam vet that never got his benefits. He calls himself I Am Waiting in My Mother's Honor, and we're going to talk about what happened. And the 14th, none other than the great and wonderful Tess Gerritsen, and we're going to talk about her movie, Island Zero, as soon as I get brave enough to watch it, which will be very soon. Seriously. So that's
that
just,
sounds awesome.
Just the... Yeah, it is. My show is booked till January 8th of 2019, at which point I'm starting off the new year with Pastor Michael Jones, and we're going to talk about goodness, hope, faith, and understanding for the world, and starting the new year off on the right foot. I want to talk about how he helps. Yeah, he helps people all over the world, so he's fantastic. So Mark realizes at the end that things are not what they seem. And you wonder if at the end she might view life and the sun might come out. Does she ever see the sun?
I think she does. And I don't think it gives anything away to say this book has a happy ending. Because I've always said all my books always have a happy ending, and they always will. Because what's the point of reading if it's not a happy ending? Sorry. That's just my personal opinion. So there's a happy ending, and she's our main character. So you can take that for what you want to take that for.
Well, you should read some of the books that I've got meaning, and some of the endings are like, why did you kill off the villain when the villain is better than the main person? And it would have been nice. Yeah, seriously. For those of you that don't know what to read, I finished it in one day. She's got mixed reviews, but I thought it was really different. Field of Bones, J.A. Jance, and I have to send her the link to the review. Juror Number 3 by my favorite person, Nancy Allen, with James Patterson. Several books that I just got that are not out yet. Heads, You Win by Jeffrey Archer. It's about Sasha and Alex, the same person, with two different names, two boys that escaped Leningrad and Russia, and how they acclimate, one to London and one to New York, because they flipped a coin to see which one was going to go, but they're the same person. So those are three books that are great, and of course T.J. O'Connor, the consultant, is always good. So how did she change from the first terrifying scene until the dramatic, electrifying scene? And tell us about Manny, because we don't want to leave this guy out. You know, got to have a couple of males in the story, too.
I liked
him.
Yes.
Sort of.
Okay. So Manny is he's hot. He is really physically attractive.
That helps.
You know, the olive skin, it helps. The black hair, he's just really dreamy and delicious. So he's there to act as a counterweight to the darkness of Mop's family. He's there as the prize at the end of the day, right? Like, if you get through this thing and you get out of this hole and you are able to overcome all of these traumas, here's this big bucket of sunshine love at the end. And it's this hot guy named Manny, right? He's that counterweight. He's part of the goal, right? So the goal being to overcome and do it on your own, and then have this amazing life with this love, who is this all-accepting, wonderful guy that she chooses, right? So that's Manny. And that's why he's there.
Well, he's good because he added a little spice and fun to the story too.
Well, he was. So yeah. I couldn't really inject. In my other books, I inject humor, you know, to take away from some of the terror and the darkness. Like my book that comes out, that I'm working on now, that comes out next July, I inject humor.
Oh, nice.
But this book, you couldn't really inject humor in it. So
no, not
the
really.
Thing I think. Right? You couldn't. So the best thing to inject here were moments of levity with love and good sex, really.
I was waiting for Mom to come out with some sarcasm here and there. But she stayed either angry or happy or whatever. So if Mom could talk about herself, what did she learn about herself, and what did she learn about Auntie Liv and Auntie Mary Patience, who I... You know, Auntie Mary Patience reminded me of some of my aunts, too. Mm-hmm. Actually, she reminded me of my mother, because perfection was the word, and I dared to... Oh, seriously. I mean, I was a perfect A student, because if I didn't get 100 on a test, I had to write it over, even if it was 99. Seriously. Yeah, Auntie Mary Patience, like she takes after my mother. And I had another aunt that was very stoic, too. Forget it. I mean, you had to listen to everybody. So what did she learn about herself, and what did she learn about Auntie Mary Patience and her other aunt? And her other aunt ever going to go for psychological help? Oh, my God.
Well, I think that what Mop learns about herself is she comes back to herself. So Mop is a character who, before all the traumas, right, had this amazing life. And this amazing outlook on life, and she was before all the traumas, really introspective and intellectual, and a really great, good person already. And then she got damaged, and then she realized how lucky she was before, how, first of all, wealthy and entitled and protected she was, and when those protections were taken away, it all fell away because she'd never learned to have to cope in an environment that she didn't have that constant love and protection and sunshine. And so by the end, so the arc of her is she starts off pretty much perfect, and then she gets damaged and is decimated. And now at the end, I think she's back to who she was, but probably better, right? Because aren't we all better after we learn that we can get through a trauma and, find our, right? So I think that's the end. That's the sunshine for her, is that she's back to herself, but better now, even better than she was before.
Sometimes you get stronger. Yeah. Sometimes you wonder just how much can I endure like Mop, and what's the next thing that's going to happen. And then I wonder if Mop ever sat down and wrote a list of all the things that happened to her and say, well, this is not so bad. I can get over it. If she actually sat down and wrote a list about everything that happened to her.
Well, yeah, because I can't imagine anything worse would happen to her again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then with Aunt Sister Mary, I think she starts to view her differently because she opens herself up to learning things about her differently. But also, Aunt Sister Mary Patience has some ownership in this relationship too. She hadn't broken down the walls between her and her niece before, and so she takes action. And so I think the two of those things coming together help them to come together.
Well, we don't talk about Auntie Mary's no-no from the past. We know that. So tell us more about Mop's father. Does he exist? Is he a good person? What would you say about her relationship with him?
Yeah, so he is a good person, and she does love him. And I think the reader, I hope, learns that he's a good guy just by the way that Auntie Liv says Joanna, her sister and Mop's mother, that Philip, which is Mop's father, deserves Joanna. So Joanna is the ultimate human, according to Auntie and Mop. She's the sunshine. Mm-hmm. She's the heart of the family. Joanna can do no wrong. And so if somebody deserves mm-hmm. her, they have to be a good person. And so Philip is a good person. He doesn't play, you know, he's a supporting character. He's there because he's got to be there. But men are not central to this book. All of the male characters are supporting characters in this book. They're mm-hmm. not evil. They're not villains. They're not anything other than supporting the women in this book, because they're not, their stories are not central at all. So, but he's there.
That makes
he's a good guy.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is girl power. Just get over it. No, seriously, it's girl power. What can I say? So you have.
I did have.
Set,
I had this.
Yes.
I had a wonderful reader reach out to me, and this reaction and this review meant the most to me, especially at this time in history. But and she's a feminist professor and author, and she read In the Vines, and she said, look, what I really appreciate about what you did with this book is the women characters are not perfect. They're actually
mm-hmm.
that's what's great about it. They're damaged, and some of them do bad things, and some of them do great things, and some of them do both. But that's what we need of women characters, and some of them are victims, and that's fine to show victims and victimhood, and some of them are heroes, and some of them are both villain and hero, right? And so she was commenting on how much she appreciated that, and that it was only women that were driving the book. And I know a lot of authors are doing that now, and there's a lot
mm-hmm.
of focus on this now. I'm not the only one. But it
no,
was
you're
nice
not.
To get. I'm definitely not the only one, but I'm happy to be part of that sorority of writers that are doing that, and that it was appreciated. So that felt nice.
Well, to be very honest, I'm finding after reading close to 8,500 books, maybe more, seriously, in the last umpteen years,
wow.
that when the main character is too perfect, it's baloney. And there's no one that's that perfect. That they don't have some kind of flaws, or that they don't get in trouble, or that they don't say the wrong thing, or they don't do the wrong thing. And when they learn about themselves and they look inside themselves at the end and they change, well, that's even better. And sometimes
mm-hmm.
they don't. I mean, I just finished, and it's not out yet, people, but you want to read it. This one James Patterson wrote himself, Target Alex Cross. And there's a character in there that claims that she works for the Justice Department. And all throughout the book, there's murders, and every single person up to the attorney general in line for the presidency gets killed. I'm not going to tell you what. Yeah, yeah. And the attorney general is supposedly the next person involved, but the Senate pro temp person doesn't know it, and then there's a fight. But from what I gather, this one particular character sending him notes that say, please stop me, Alex Cross. And throughout the book, I knew that it was this person. And at the end, something happens with her, and I realize why, but they don't end it why. So you wonder, you know, what was James Patterson thinking at the end of the book?
Oh.
She was totally flawed. She had a double personality, and she knew it. So she used one for her job and one to entice men. And she had two personalities. Yeah, it was scary. And she tried to explain, and she even came on to Alex Cross. That was a no-no. And, yeah, it was different. And the last line of the book, after we find out what happens to her, was, like, why didn't he listen? And that was scary. Because he's a great character, but they don't make him perfect either at all. They make him kind
yeah,
of
no.
very flawed. But I did tell Nancy Allen, when she speaks to James Patterson, that he cannot kill off Nana Mama, the 90-year-old grandmother, because she's my favorite character and she's the one with the brains. So they cannot kill off Nana Mama. James Patterson, don't even think it. So one question before we find out, yeah, seriously, what happens next is you go to Rye, New Hampshire, the estate, and Italy. How come those particular locations for this particular book?
Oh, all right. So Rye, New Hampshire, because the first time I even got the notion to write this book, I was in Rye, New Hampshire. And Rye, New Hampshire, it has these amazing seaside mega estates. And so that's why I picked that. It's really picturesque. Italy, because I love Italy, and my goal is to live part of the year there at some point. Like, that's a real goal. It's not a pipe dream. Trying to get to do that. So in my mind, any character who ever goes to Italy in any of my books, it's because that's the ultimate thing. And then the other location, of course, is Auntie's property, which is a fictional place between Rockport and Gloucester, Massachusetts, because that's where I live and I know the area. So it was easy for me to write the scenery.
Well, that makes it easy when you know where you are. So, and some of the scenes were so graphic that I knew right away, you know, where it was. And I could even picture that kitchen scene. And that's probably why, ladies and gentlemen, Fran doesn't go to the kitchen anymore unless they get permission. Yeah, I know. I have a very limited diet for whatever reason. And I'm very proud to say that I lost 25 pounds and I'm back down to 112. And I intend to stay there forever.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't even know how much I weighed until someone weighed me the other day. I go, am I really that skinny? Oh, goody. But, yeah. It's amazing. You know, sometimes you look at yourself and you don't know who you are. And then you look at yourself and they go like, oh yeah, that's who I am, right? That's today. And then there's tomorrow. So what is next for you? And tell us about the new book that's going to come out next year that I want before everybody else, naturally.
I'm excited. It's called Gretchen, and Gretchen is a mashed up of a domestic thriller with a gothic horror. And it is essentially about a teen daughter and her mom who are on the run, and they've been on the run for 13 years. But it's not a story about a mother and daughter on the run. What it actually ends up being is where they land in the next place they run to ends up being the worst possible place for them to land. Because it's this crazy estate with horror going on. And so there's a couple twists that I'm not going to give away that form the backstory of why they're on the run. But it's fun. It's all the readers, my editor, everybody, my agent have said it's incredibly creepy, but compared to In the Vines, it's lighter. It's a different feel, I guess. So, and it takes place in New Hampshire.
Oh, nice.
Carmel, yeah. So two locations for it is Carmel, California, and Northern New Hampshire. So I'm really, really, really excited about this book. I had a blast writing Gretchen.
Is this the same publisher that you used for In the Vines, or are you going with somebody else this time?
No, this is with Thomas and Mercer. Yes, my same for In the Vine.
Yeah. Well, the company that sends me everything, and I never, that I'm lucky, is beside Thomas. If I ask for Thomas and Mercer, not to worry. Ashley will send me. Don't worry about that.
Yeah.
So
yeah, they're really great.
They send me everything. It's scary. And sometimes I don't even know they're sending it, and they send it anyway, which is how I got your book, by the way. That's the truth. I read Method, and I'm saying, I get this book in the mail, and they go, no, wait a minute. I know I read something by Shannon Kirk, and I looked it up, and they go, wait a minute, it's on my site, on my Just Review site. And I'm going like, who sent this? And I had no idea until Ashley emailed me and said, do you want to read it? I go, I guess I already have it. And I'm going, yeah. Seriously, I mean, you never know. I never know what's going to come in the mail. I just got Clive Gus's new book. And she agreed, and then I got a few others, and I'm going like, this is so cool. I don't have to ask. So I want to thank you so very much. It's cloudy outside, but I'm going to get some fresh air because I need some fresh air. I really appreciate this. Are you coming to the Thriller Fest next year?
In Thriller Fest in New York?
Yeah.
Yes, I am. I am going this year. Absolutely.
Oh, that would be really cool, because I just hope they remember to invite the Queen of Bookers who's over here, please. I'll be very, you know, what can I say? it's a lot of fun, and the panels are fun. And I got to meet George Martin last year and get his autograph for my niece, so that was fun, too, for an hour standing online. But, yeah, only for my niece. So thank you so much, everybody. Have a beautiful day, Shannon. Thank you so much, everybody, and goodbye.
Thank you, friends.